I'm glad to see everyone's up and early this morning, despite the time change. Last Wednesday, we began our study of Ecclesiastes, and we were going through discussing what Ecclesiastes mean, and the author, and we were talking about some of the arguments against the authorship of Solomon. Actually, one thing to point out, Craig mentioned to me Wednesday night after class that we were just an interesting side note. When we're talking about the ensnarement of women, that the author has mentioned, he mentioned he found one man in 1,000, but a woman he did not find among these. If we look at back in 1 Kings, and Solomon talks about he had 1,000 women, 300 concubines, 700 wives, or maybe the opposite way, 300 wives, 700 concubines. But yeah, he had 1,000 women, and so when he says he couldn't find one in 1,000, he really tried. but like Ms. Montna mentioned, he wasn't always looking in the right spot when he selected his companions. Anyway, I think we stopped at the particular phrases in verse 16 of chapter 1. I think we stopped at that one, where the term "all before me." This is again talking about the people's contesting Solomon as the author. And in verse 16, it says, "I commune with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge." And it's this term, "all who were before me in Jerusalem," that they feel is worded strangely, that they say, or I guess they take that meaning, the interpretation is all who were before me as this is the king, so all who were before him were the other kings. And we know that the only king in his line before him was David, and then of course Saul, who wasn't of the same line. Like, that doesn't make any sense. All were before him, there wasn't hardly anyone before him at all. But that it doesn't say all the kings that were before him. It's just talking about, he says, you know, he has more wisdom than all were before him. I think it's, you know, meaning is, Jerusalem's been around a long, long time. It's all men before him. And we know that if you turn to Ecclesiastes, so, 1 Kings, chapter 4, as we read this scripture previously, but in chapter 4, verse 30, it says, "Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the east and of all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men," in verse 31. We know Solomon was the wisest of all, so to interpret that as just as the kings before him is sort of restricting, and I don't think that's really what it's saying. Like I said, I've said it before, these arguments against Solomon are fairly weak in my eyes. And our next page, in page 3, the last phrase that they use to contest or the beliefs and disagreement is in chapter 2, verse 18. The preacher says, "Then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me." And this is a very true statement for all of us. Whatever we possess here on earth will be left to those who come after us. They argument this is that Solomon had chosen his predecessor, but we believe this is written in his old age, so by then he's had many, many, many sons. He had chosen a predecessor, he would have known who it was that would take over his possessions. And here it refers to him very, an impersonal reference to what is his own son. And they're like, he wouldn't have done that. Of course, there's some bold assumptions of what he would and wouldn't do. And also, as we said before, we looked at this book, he's going about this as a philosopher, as a wise man, and laying out the facts and analyzing them very objectively. So there isn't a lot of personal attachment. And so I think you see the same thing here that would speak against, you know, that he's, yes, he's being impersonal, but the whole book is to some extent objective and impersonal. Does anyone have any comments? If you're reading the scripture, how would you interpret it? Did you come to the same conclusion as I have, or does anyone differ? All right. Same conclusion. So, those are a few arguments against Solomon, and I think there's a few others that were even weaker than these, so I didn't even want to go into them. We don't want to spend the whole time discussing why he wouldn't be the author. I believe he's the author. We have a lot of fact that shows a correlation between the preacher and Solomon, and I think we should rely on those facts that in the circumstances that Solomon was so great, he was so differentiated from anyone else, that they show the same key points that link these two. I don't think it would be anyone else but Solomon. And what is the purpose of this book? In Ecclesiastes chapter, first chapter beginning verse 3. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? Is that a question or a purpose?
Kind of like a rhetorical question.
Yeah, he's posing this question, and he's going to seek to answer this question. That's his purpose. His purpose of this entire book is to try to answer this question. You know, what profit has man from all his toils under the sun? And when I first read that, first thing that comes to my mind is the same thing people ask today. You know, what purpose do I have in life? You know, what, a lot of times it's phrased, what's the meaning of life? And I actually slightly regret that, putting that here. That's what first comes to my mind. What is the meaning of life? What is the purpose of life? But as we read through, I go into a lot of definition, trying to define words and differentiate, you know, things, and hopefully this won't add to any confusion, this term, the meaning of life. Because here he's talking about, he's not really, we'll get into that later. There's a slight difference. He's trying to find out what do we profit, what do we gain. It's not necessarily talking about what is the meaning. You may have meaning in doing something without any profit at all. So I think we'll cover that fairly soon, hopefully today. But, you know, he goes through this book objectively, stating out the facts and analyzing them and coming to conclusions based on logical reasoning. And a lot of some of these principles of philosophy have been applied to this book, the Epicurean, Stoic, and Cynic philosophies, which were developed by the Greeks, for whom they were named, hundreds of years later. I don't want to get into too much of them. I have looked them up if you want more information, Wikipedia or any Greek philosophy book, you can get into it. But using his wisdom by logically analyzing all the data, he comes up with an answer, an answer of how we should live our lives. And in fact, he comes up with two answers. And we'll see why when we come to the theme and the focus of this book.
The word profit, Michael, helps me to think of it. You engage in transaction. You've got expenses and investment. And then whatever you get in return, the profit is what you have left over after you get whatever you got income minus your expenses or investment. That's your profit.
Yes.
So here we invest this lifetime of whatever it is. He's going to go through all the things he invested. And with all of that, and considering the return, what has he got at the end? What's left? What can he take with him now?
Yeah.
And of course, the answer would be nothing.
Correct. And we're getting there. Yes.
I was just going ahead to the New Testament, but just to go off what he was saying, if you go to 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 6, it says, but godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. For what have we brought nothing into the world so we can not take anything out of it? I just think, you know, the prophet for us would be godliness. I mean, that'd be the spiritual prophet.
Yes, and we're about to leap into all of that. I agree with you.
No, that's all.
Yeah.
It's just that Ecclesiastes not considering.
Correct. We're about to get into the theme of the book. And before, like I said, what is the prophet? And then he specifies under the sun. The eternal life, that which comes after, isn't within the focus of what, you know, what we do is determines our eternal afterlife, but when he narrows in the focus, he comes in on just under the sun. You work, you labor for things, and then you die. And if that's all you're looking at, well, you have no profit, because what you gain is lost. And so, but yeah, David is absolutely correct. When we step back as Christians, and we look at, you know, how we live for God, and the view of eternity, that is exactly what we profit as Christians. And then, of course, that, you know, is the answer at the end of Ecclesiastes, when Solomon steps back from this narrow view. And now I'm starting to jump all ahead of myself. But, it's something we're going to be coming back to over and over again, because, you know, this book, in order to keep you on track, does repeat things. As a matter of fact, in verse 2, right before the question is posed, which is what our theme is, in verse 2, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. That is the answer to his question. It's the same, it's a common method they use to ask the question and answer it without getting into the details to prove it. Here's a question, here's the answer right now, you know. If you walked away from his sermon, you would already know the answer without being able to prove it. And hopefully, you would stick around and find out why he's right. And that's why we're going to study the book, to look at why he is right. How did he get to that conclusion? That's the theme of our book, Vanity of Vanities. And I've asked you to go through the book and then mark that phrase or any phrase with a similar idea. And of course, we're about to get into defining what is vanity. You come up with some of the synonyms, but and of course it depends on your translation, your version of the number you'll come up with under the New Americans one-off. And then also, like I said, the synonyms you use, it's not always, I marked off everything with that same thought, vanity, striving after the wind, that which is futile, it's fleeting. I come up with about 47 or 48 if you're using the King James. And if you catch them all. I had to go through a couple times. I assume everyone came up with something pretty close. And also ask you to... And of course we'll see vanity. Vanities is in every single chapter, I think, except for the last. And it's through multiple times through every single chapter. And also mark the word profit or one advantage, which is the idea of what do we gain on earth. And I came up with 15 different instances. So vanity of vanity, all is vanity. How would we define vanity? Now, Merriam-Webster's dictionary defines it as something that is vain, empty, or valueless. Does anyone agree with that? Or?
Well, if you call a person vain, wouldn't that person be self-willed, I guess? Everything for him or herself? I mean, that's kind of taking a little far out, but I mean...
Well, yeah, there's more than one definition of vain, of course. There's the vein of, something can be vain or someone can be vain. It depends on how you use it. But in our case, if we use the same definition of empty or valueless to say someone's vain, is saying they're sort of empty or futile, useless. But then, yeah, people are like, people who look in the mirror and they say that person is vain. That's a different idea. I forgot the definition of exactly how you describe it, but, you know, they're... Yes, superficial, they're pleased with themselves, you know, with their beauty or whatever aspect.
I like the definition you have down here that says, that which leaves no measurable or adequate result.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That was really on target with what he was trying to convey.
Yes. And it's also for the one below it, the two together bring us to the final conclusion. In getting there, the Hebrew term, as they applied it, literally means a breath or a light wind. And from that we know, you know, a breath is quick. Like if you, on a cold day, you breathe and you actually see the vapor from your breath, it doesn't stick around long, does it? It's there and it's gone. A light wind or both. It's the idea of it's quick, it passes away quickly, and the fact that it's very insignificant. It's very light. It's something which nearly can't be measured. And that's how they would describe it. That which passes away quickly and completely. Also that which leaves no measurable or adequate result. So through here, when we use this term, it doesn't necessarily mean something has no result. It's just that if there is a result, it may be there, but it's gone quick. Or it may be very, very slight, so slight that it's not worth the measuring. And so, you know, you come with it's close enough to zero. 0.0003 is zero for most of us. So
I that's call it in chapter 114, and actually out the book, vanity couples striving after wind.
Yes.
That presents a vivid picture to me. If I tried to catch the wind and put it in my pockets, I'd take this home.
Yeah. Exactly. Striving or...
That's the idea of vanity, that no money.
Yeah. Can you grasp, my word first one is grasp the wind. Can you grasp the wind and lay hold of it? No. There's no catching the wind. And so, it's going to be a futile, you know, maybe full of effort, but you're not going to have any results. It's synonymous with, you know, futile, empty, valueless. Also the word fleeting. So, like I said, if there was something, it's fleeting and it's gone, and it's no longer there to be measured. Now, it doesn't have the same meaning as senseless or meaningless. And that's why, before I mentioned how I was scared, I didn't want to lead to confusion with that. What is the meaning of life? Even though I put it in there. But, you know, like when we talk about... you could do something and say you suppose you're doing it for someone else. You get no profit out of it. But there was a meaning behind it and a sense of why you performed it. You know, and later we're going to get into emotions and all this. You know, if you can get an emotion out of it, and that's considered, you know, profitless, the actual result of getting the emotion, because it's so fleeting. But you still perform the task for that sense of meaning, to get some, say, enjoyment out of it, even though enjoyment is quickly lost. It's gone, you know, in a lot of cases. So I hope, is that clear to everyone? And try to do my best to convey my thoughts. And I want to get Rocky.
You know, we're defining the word vanity, and we find that there's actually a phrase that's coupled there, and really I think gets the concept across just there in verse 2. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. In Enumerated Standards, a little footnote on vanity of vanities, it says futility of futilities. And if you look at that phrase there, and of course it's been repeated, you know, talking about defining the word vanity, but we have vanity of vanities. I think the concept there is it's talking about the ultimate futility. I mean, that's just, yeah, you find the word vain, but we got this thing, this phrase, and it's taken it to the highest level. It's all vanity.
Yeah.
It's the ultimate.
It's a superlative, the most vain. And we know in the New Testament, in Hebrews 9, we hear about God as the Holy of Holies. Same idea, the holy to the highest degree. You know, here it's vanity to the highest degree. The most vain. And so, yeah, Rocky's right on track. Any other comments? I mean, it's really important to understand this term, because as we go through, we're going to assume this is the correct interpretation. The interpretation is very important to how we're understanding conclusions he reasons out.
Well, you know, it just goes back to something you made, a point you made earlier. What's really important, though, is keep in mind what's in view of the player.
Yes, that's correct.
Life under the sun, and it is, I can start with nothing, I can do all this, put forth all this effort in the multitude of ways he talked about, and at the end of the day, maybe good things I did along the way. Your point about having meaning of some sort.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, you and I are going to end up in the same place.
At the end of the
day,
to
have zero. There are no 0.3 or 0.003. There's zero you're going to have in terms of life under the sun.
Correct. And then we're getting there. I also had that as well, but yeah, correct. I mean, you may get something out of it, but it, like I said, that's why I bring in the term of fleeting. It's short term. And at the end, it's gone. Dave?
Yeah, this just reminds me of exercise. You know, say you're in your middle 20s, you work out all the time, then you get 30s, you can't work out as much, then you get 40, and you're barely making it.
Hey, be careful.
Yourself, John.
But, like, you know, exercise profits you while you're able to do it. But then we're all going to, Lord willing, if we reach 50, 60, 70, you know, even 90, I mean, it's not going to profit us because we're all going to end up 6 feet under, regardless.
Yeah.
Unless the Lord comes. But, I mean.
And also... Yeah, that's exactly the case. Also, with working out, like you mentioned, you could be 20 and you work out and you get strong, and you could still be 20 and you stop working out. What happens to your profit? You atrophy. You're not working out. You don't maintain it, and it's gone. Anyway, you don't have to get to 50 to lose it. You know, as soon as you stop and you start vegging on the couch, whatever you work for is lost. It slowly goes away, and sometimes rather quickly. All right. Also, as we discussed, that the purpose was to find the prophet. We know the answer is vanity. All is vanity. What is the prophet? Well, there isn't any. But how are we defining prophet? And it's, you know, we look to the Webster's Merriam Dictionary. Merriam-Webster's Dictionary. That's the one I like to go to. This is a valuable return. And we also see the idea of the excess of returns over expenditure after the completion of a transaction, which is right along the lines of Mr. Fano mentioned earlier. That's as a, you know, in terms of investing, which it's a touchy subject right now. But when you invest, you know, if anyone's who's investing, they're looking for something at the end, a gain. They're going to buy something for this, and the hope is to sell it for more to have. You know, you get back whatever it is you've invested in, whatever you're holding, and the hope is to have more money within the terms of investing. You know, you don't want to buy something and then sell it right back for the exact same price, and what do you have? Absolutely nothing. Why did you even perform the task? So it's, you know, it's profit. Synonymous with advantage, with gain, with the benefit. You receive some sort of benefit. They all have similar meaning. And it's in complete opposition to vanity. You know, here we're talking about we have to have a gain, and vanity is empty, zero. So these two are at odds in the book. It's one or the other. And all right, so there is no profit. We know all is vanity. There is no profit. And if, in the book, like in chapter 7. The only profit that's mentioned in this book, anything that improves us is, or not improves us, but anything that's noted as better or having any profit is comparing one thing to the other. In chapter 7, we look at that, verse 11. It says, wisdom is good with an inheritance and profitable to those who see the sun. And I think some versions it says, wisdom is good over an inheritance. Is it better to have wisdom? I think it's the idea better to have wisdom or inheritance. Well, wisdom is better because you can... Inheritance is just receiving goods. With wisdom, I guess the idea is maybe you can accumulate your own goods. But you also see that in chapter 2, verse 13, when wisdom and folly are compared. In 2:13 it says, then I saw that wisdom excels folly. So, this is better than that. You'll see that within this book. But we won't see how man is better off. We won't see the profit or the advantage man gains. So, you know, the idea of better here is not the same as profit. You know, wisdom isn't getting any profit over folly. It's just, it is better than. And so, even if you had some gains, like we mentioned before, the fleeting nature of life negates all possible gains. It's zero at the end. You know, anything that's gained is quickly lost. You know, even from our standpoint of view within our lives, you know, I mentioned emotions before. You know, I guess I keep coming back to emotions. Well, I do this, and I do get profit. I have some enjoyment out of it, and that's profitable, right? And then when we go back to the term, you know, of vanities, you know, the idea that it's quick, it's fleeting, and you find that's the case with emotions. And I had to go through this in my head to make sure, you know, to keep myself on track with these conclusions. Like, you could do something, you make yourself happy, and that's a good feeling. That's what we, you know, we'd all rather be happy than sad. But, you know, you could be leaving Chuck E. Cheese's with the kids after a very enjoyable time. And you come out, and you're happy, and then someone's keyed your car. Are you happy anymore? Not feeling very happy. And then your happiness doesn't come back quickly either. And so it's very, very fleeting. And without, and a lot of times outside of our control, you know, things occur, and then it's gone. You know, events in our lives, you know, however, you know, whatever it may be, and often happiness is difficult to attain. So this idea of fleeting, it's quick. If you say, oh, this is profitable, compare the time frame. How, you know, fleeting is it? And even if you had something your whole life, when we pass away and our lives are short, you lose it. So anything you could gain in this life as under the sun in this earth is left with the earth when you pass on. So there is no profit. And did I miss something?
I have a question.
Yes.
I know we're talking about nothing that's profit and then under the sun, but when we're talking about wisdom and Solomon was, you know, the wisest king of all. Can't you pass down wisdom from generation to generation? But I mean, your riches you can pass down, but eventually they'll run out. But what about that wisdom if you can pass it down? I mean, we know you were talking about how it's mentioned in here is, you know, wisdom versus folly is better than, but that was just one of the questions I had.
Yeah. Well, do we know how they built the pyramids? We know they built them, but we don't have the wisdom to how they built them. People are still trying to figure it out.
And you pass down knowledge.
Yes.
But wisdom has to be developed on your own.
Yeah, that's,
you can apply for yourself.
Yeah, that's exactly true. We're going to have to define those as well. But yeah, wisdom and knowledge are sometimes synonymous and sometimes they're not, depending on the context you're using them. I guess, yeah, there is knowledge can be passed down, but only someone who is understanding can grasp that knowledge and become wise.
Right,
a fool could take the knowledge and have the book and never get it. You never have the understanding to be wise. But, yeah, in all cases, wisdom has to be developed by the person, and any knowledge that can be passed down can easily be lost as well. You know, they have the Dark Ages that you went through in Europe. It's called the Dark Ages because knowledge was lost. There was no focus on that. When everyone turns to sustaining their own lives, and, you know, in traumatic times, knowledge is forgotten. The great Library of Alexandria, it was supposedly one of the wonders of the world with all the knowledge it had, and it was destroyed, and all that knowledge was lost. Jim, you had a question?
Bottom line is, wisdom, too, it's, when it's all over, there's no good, it's gone.
Exactly.
I don't care if the wisest man in the world is Solomon, there's no good, it's gone.
If we're looking under the sun, and there's nothing after life, you can gain all the wisdom of the world, and when you die, if there's nothing after, your wisdom goes with you, and it's lost. And what good is your wisdom going to do of life on earth? You know, say for a moment there is nothing after earth. You know, it's gone. And even if you know, we know, of course, there is eternal life. But knowledge of the earth, when there is no earth, what's that benefit you? I know how the birds do this, and I know why the trees produce chlorophyll and energy. And even if when we are in heaven, what does it matter anymore?
Michael, look at chapter. I know you can come into this, but since the question was raised, look at chapter 2, the last phrase in verse 16. He does a very big here talk about it. compared with the Benfica.
Yes.
Points out, as you've already commented, that there's an advantage in wisdom. There's a profit in wisdom during the span of life. But at the end of verse 16, the wise man and the fool both die. Let's suppose you had all kinds of knowledge you passed down. What good did that do you?
Yeah, exactly.
You and that fool who spent his life drinking whiskey and laying in the gutter, y'all both the same place. You say, well, what about eternity? You're not considering that.
Yes. Rocky?
You know, we have benefited today from a lot of people that come before us in terms of knowledge, roads, institutions, organizations, a lot of things. So we have benefited a lot. Again, I think any time questions like this come up, you go back to what is the context here, what is the scene. And we're looking at life under the sun for a man. And you know, that's not to say that there's a lot of benefit for past knowledge, but it's for a person. And what does it benefit him? Under the sun.
Yes.
And so I think a lot of these things, you got to keep that view in mind when you start asking these questions, I think.
Yeah. And we know Solomon, he was wise, and he went about this, we're going to learn, he went about this not just offhand, kind of loosey-goosey. You know, he systematically went through everything under the sun. He was wiser than any of us, and he covers all these things we're kind of talking about. He covers it all. And we're going to get to it eventually. And I think I skipped over a spot, but these two tie in together. I was at number 6 on page 4, but back in Under the Purpose, we were talking about, what is it? Maybe I didn't cover this as clear as I want to. Sometimes I get fast and skip ahead. We were talking about, what was the specific focus of the study? I have that question there. And when we looked at verse 3, and we were just speaking about all this, what profit has man from all his labor, in which he toils under the sun? This is this defines the context of all the scriptures in this book. You know, and we must remember that context in verse 3. Under what do we gain under the sun? That's the context we need to stick to in order to correctly interpret these scriptures. That's the focus he uses when he's taking this, gathering this data under the sun, analyzing it within that scope and coming to these conclusions. If we break out of that isolated system, that scope of reference he's using, then we'll go, these conclusions don't make sense, and they won't, because we've removed ourselves out of the isolated system he's created. I'm starting to use engineering terms. But in engineering, you know, when we're discussing energy and trying to do the calculations, you isolate the system to this tub of water, not the entire Earth. Just that tub of water, and ignore everything outside of that tub of water and dealing with the energy of the interaction between warm water and ice and so forth and the movement of energies. You isolate that system and you have a point of reference to make the calculations, to make, you know, the assumptions and judgments and come to a conclusion. And here, the author, Solomon, is doing the same thing. He's isolating the system of discussion under the sun, only under the sun. He establishes that point of reference. If you were to move yourself to a different point of reference, his conclusions are no longer valid. And so, to correctly interpret everything he says, to know that he's right, we have to stay within that focus, that reference. And it's difficult. I find it difficult for us, probably for all of us, as for Christians in particular, because we're so used to thinking about life eternal, what we need to do, how to obey God, to receive life eternal, and that is a much larger scope than what he's dealing with. And so we have to contract in, you know, out of that and remember his scope, his frame of reference he's discussing. And of course it's repeated over and over and over through here. We talked about how many markings there were, and I got 42 of under the heaven and land on earth, and on land and under the sun. And so it's repeated over and over and over to make sure we understand that, yes, this is the scope of the frame of what he's speaking about, all these things, you know. And so secondly, that way we can't use the dangers. We can't use the conclusions we read here in that scope and say, yes, he's analyzed this data. It's true. We know it's true. Now let's take it over here to Matthew 14 to understand something there and apply this truth over there. Well, that can't work. Because everywhere else in the scripture is talking about life after Earth, or implies a much larger meaning. We would then use these scriptures in a context in which they don't fit and misinterpret other scriptures. So these things are only true in this scope. So we don't want to misinterpret these, and we don't want to use these to misinterpret something else. Do you have anything to add to that?
That's difficult.
It is difficult. There's, like I said, we're Christians and we're used to thinking of the larger scheme of what God has planned. It's hard to narrow in, or at least stay narrowed in, for a long period of time. Even when I'm reading, I'll narrow in and I'm, yeah, I get it. And all of a sudden I kind of, poof, I pop out to the big window. That doesn't make sense. I'm doing it again. And I narrow back in on what he's saying. And that goes in with on page 4 where we were and we made it to. And remember the narrow view of life in this book. And when we look at Ecclesiastes chapter 2 and 15, and then we list, I list several different verses. 2:15, it said, "So in my heart, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then more wise? And I said in my heart, this also is vanity." 19 in chapter 3. "What happens to the sons of men also happens to animals. One thing befalls them, as one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all are from the dust, and all return to the dust." And we'll see the same message in the following scriptures in 5:16. And also in chapter 7, and in 5:16, "And this also is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind?" As we come into the earth with nothing, we go out of the earth with nothing. And so, what's the message we see in all these scriptures? What's he conveying?
All die.
Yeah, everything dies. He's sort of saying, this life on earth, that's all there is, just for the sake of these, this study. Life on earth, there's nothing after. Life on earth, you die, boom, it's over. we go to compare that with the Ephesians 5 and 15. "See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time because the days are evil." I think here he's saying, walk wisely, do according to this. In 2 Corinthians 4:16. Oh, that's a long one. 4:16, "Therefore I urge you, imitate me. For this reason I have sent Timothy to you, who is my beloved and faithful son in the Lord, who will remind you of my ways in Christ, as I teach everywhere in every church." Oh wait, I'm in the wrong place. I'm in 1 Corinthians. I'm in 2. Something's wrong. Alright, here we are. 2 Corinthians 4:16. "Therefore, we do not lose heart, even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. For a light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. The things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal." And so, you don't have to read all of these scriptures, but we see the idea conveyed here. What is being conveyed? The idea of life on earth is not it. Yes, life on earth is perishing, but there's more. There's eternity. Life, life in heaven, life with God. And so there's, the different differentiation between these scriptures and Ecclesiastes and his scope and elsewhere, in the rest of the book. And let's turn to Ecclesiastes 2:24. Based on, that scope, what is the conclusion that the preacher often comes up with. 2:24. Nothing is better for a man that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. Verse 12 of chapter 3. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives. And also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. Verse 22. I perceive that nothing is better than a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage or portion. So, the message he's giving us?
Enjoy your money. Spend some money.
Yeah. What's the best thing we can do? Enjoy what we have. And that's the best thing we can do. Remember, within that focus he's talking about. We look at the rest of the scriptures, Luke 12. And in verse 15, he spoke a parable to them, saying, "The ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, 'What shall I do, since I have no room to store my crops?' So he said, 'I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there I will store all my crops and goods. And I will say to my soul, Soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.'" And it's the same thing we see in Ecclesiastes. But, in verse 20, God said to him, "Fool, this night your souls will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." Is he this direct, we see the same conclusion from the deal and then say, no, that's foolish to enjoy everything you have on earth without thinking about something more. Also in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 32, 1 Corinthians 15. "If in the manner of men I have fought with beasts at Ephesus, what advantage is it to me? If the dead do not rise, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." And here, they say, yeah, we see the same thing. If the dead do not rise, let us eat and drink. That's the advantage. But we know that the dead do rise. We talk about, Paul is discussing then the resurrection in Matthew 16:26. I think it was the last one. For what profit is to a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? And so here we see the message is it's not gaining and possessing and enjoying. It's not to say we can't do that, but there's a different focus. The focus shouldn't be on enjoying life, but on serving to make it to heaven, to have rewards in heaven, to be in heaven one day. And so we see the focus is different. Focus here, serve, don't serve yourself, enjoy life receive eternal life in heaven. Ecclesiastes, all we're talking about is life, so the best thing is to enjoy it. It's not, the focus is different. There's no mention of life after. But it's not much. And we'll stop there. We almost finished it. That's okay.